Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
When you think about people living on less than $2 a day, maybe you picture an urban slum or a dilapidated rural shack in the developing world. Of course, in this country, $2 a day is barely enough to buy a dozen eggs or a small loaf of bread at the grocery store. And yet, in communities all over America, 1.5 million U.S. households have about $2 per day per person to spend. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Like a lot of you, I've heard UN statistics that nearly half the world's population subsists on this amount of cash. I just had no idea that anybody in the U.S. was that poor. The figure took my guest by surprise as well, and he wanted to understand how these families ended up in such desperate poverty and what they have to do to survive it. H. Luke Schaefer is associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Social Work and the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy research affiliate at the National Poverty Center. His new book, written with co-author Catherine J. Eden, is called $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America, and he joins us as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. Luke, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Your colleague Catherine Eden was doing field work among the poorest of the poor in America, and she started to notice this rise in the numbers of people who had essentially no cash income from anywhere. And as you explain in the book, as a good scientist, you tried very hard to prove those observations wrong. You thought it couldn't be true. What made you think initially that her observations might simply be a coincidence?
I think when we had our initial conversation, I was up visiting her, and she said she'd been going into more and more of homes, just like you said, where they didn't just have not enough money, they seemed to have no money at all. And they might have some important non-cash benefits, such as a housing subsidy, although that's quite uncommon, actually, or food stamps, now called SNAP, but they didn't have any cash. And I thought that this was an interesting insight, and so we wanted to. I'm a data nerd, and so I wanted to go back to the data and see. You know, she'd been doing ethnography and had been writing important books about poverty for the last 20 years. I wanted to see, could we see an uptick in families living on virtually no cash at all? And I think I, like a lot of Americans, didn't really think about subsistence at a level like that. You sort of think about American poverty as maybe being qualitatively different, and I'd spent a lot of my career actually looking at the challenges of the working poor up the income ladder, a little bit still poor, but up the income ladder from the families who we write about in this book. So we went to the best data source that we could find. It wasn't perfect. It's a household survey, and that's where we found this striking finding, which sort of led us down the course of doing this book.
And that striking finding was that the numbers of U.S. households in $2-a-day poverty had more than doubled in 15 years.
That's right. In fact, we're just talking about families with kids because we were tracing it back to some government policy changes that we made in the 1990s, some which positively impacted the poor and some that we think had grave consequences, which is what this book is about. So we're not even talking about all U.S. households. We're just talking about families with children. And we started this work in 2011, and we found when you looked at the best data, the data that records the most income among the poor of what we have available, we could see about 1.5 million families. And we would take all the income coming into the house, whether or not somebody was related to a mom and a kid or parents and children. And it was 1.5 million families with about 3 million children, and that's well over double what we saw in 1996.
Yeah, it's actually 4% of U.S. households with children. To put that in perspective, it's as if every K-12 class in the country with 25 kids in it would include one getting by on $2 a day.
That's right. That's right. And this is at the month level. So we're talking about at any given month, you have families that are below this threshold. But yeah, that's one out of every 25 kids, as you say, if you looked out at a classroom of elementary school kids that had 25 in there, one it would account for one of them.
And you can trace this rise directly to 1996. What happened that year?
Well, we really started in 1996 for a couple of reasons. One, we thought it was the cleanest comparison given the way that the data were structured. But also, 1996 was when we made a big shift in our cash assistance program, what a lot of people think about welfare. And we went from a program that was broadly available to eligible families to a new program called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And you can tell by the title, it's maybe a bit more restrictive. It's a program that puts time limits in virtually all states, and the federal government puts time limits on the use of federal funds and imposes work requirements on able-bodied recipients.
And it's so hard to get that a lot of social services organizations that would help people sign up for things like SNAP benefits, they don't even bother filling out the paperwork because they assume their clients will not qualify.
That's right. We actually see this among the families whose stories we tell in the book. A lot of our folks who, the ones who knew about it were often reluctant to apply because the program carries a certain stigma to it here in the United States. But we had one, Ray McCormick from Cleveland, Ohio, who has had a long history of work and considers herself a worker, but it just hit on incredibly hard times that we talk about in the book. And she finally went in to get aid, and she was told when she came in by a caseworker, "I'm sorry, there's just so many people who need help. There's not enough to go around. Come back next year."
Hmm.
We asked Madonna Harris in Chicago, "Why haven't you applied? You're living in a family homeless shelter. You've been in a succession of these for months. You have nothing to your name." And she said, "Well, they're just not giving that out anymore. It becomes so rare among the people that she knew that we really think of it as virtually dead. There's some states that are better than others." And we heard this from the families, and as you say, we also heard it from social service providers. There's some good research on state practices that might lead to some of this, but in Atlanta, there was a Slate article a few years ago quoting someone who works for the Atlanta Community Food Bank, and she said, "Oh, we don't even bother sending people over there to apply because it's just not worth it."
I was really struck, Luke, and of course there are exceptions, but it seems like the majority of the people that you profile in the book have significant work histories. These are not people who never worked, never wanted to work, would prefer to stay home.
That's right, and I think that's something that surprised me too. When I got over the initial shock and seeing these large numbers and clearly going in the wrong direction when we look at the data, I still sort of had this image, I think, of people being completely disconnected from society in a way, maybe living in a kind of poverty that we think of as being in other countries. But as we started to talk with families, we really found this very close attachment to the labor market and a real sort of them considering themselves as workers. They wanted to work, and they were proud of the work that they had done, but either because of instability in their jobs or instability in their family lives, they would usually lose a job. That's often a precursor, we think, to one of these long spells below $2 a day. And that sort of set a spiral downward that would usually go for a fair amount of time. And one of the things that we really tried to do in this book was really pair the stories of families. So we went out into different parts of the country and followed families across a number of different places to sort of compare the themes. And we would see this connection to the labor market, often across the field sites. But then we would always look back to the nationally representative data. And when we look longitudinally at kids, if we take a kid in the data, this is a survey of income and program participation, we can see them over the course of the year. We would see about 70% of children who experienced at least 3 months below this $2 per person per day threshold lived in a house where somebody worked. That's 70% lived in a house where somebody had a formal job in the year surrounding the spell. And only about 10% of them were in families who got on TANF.
One fascinating observation in this book relates to housing. The news team here at KERA has done some reporting on the challenges of homeless students, a category that technically includes families who are doubled up in living quarters with other families. It would seem like a protective factor against the worst poverty, right? Maybe you're not paying rent or you're paying less. In fact, it puts people at increased risk.
Yeah, I think particularly among the groups that we're writing about. So in some cases, I think having the opportunity to double up with family can be one of the best thing that happens. And we do have some stories like that in the book. Susan Brown was able to live in an old family home deep on the south side of Chicago. And I think that was the only thing between her and her family and the street. In a lot of cases, what we would see was you would take families who are very vulnerable. They've usually experienced some sort of crisis, and they have no power. And it seems to us that many of the families who we followed were sort of situated among family and friends who weren't not just unhelpful. You know, didn't just not help very much, but in a lot of cases were actually quite harmful. So Jennifer Hernandez was in Chicago and had been working in a job at a spa where she'd been asked to do overtime without being paid the overtime rate. And she was working pretty much constantly, and she and her finally she took up an invitation to move down to Abilene, Texas. And by the way, all the names of the folks in our book are anonymized, and some of the places have been changed to protect their identities. But she moved down and ended up staying with an uncle and an aunt, and the uncle was a very reputable person who had held a steady job for a long time. And she ended up walking in on her uncle and her on her young daughter, and the uncle was molesting her daughter. And this perpetuated that cycle over the long term. So we want to be very careful not to suggest that this is a primary facet of the lives of the poor in general, but particularly among the group that we studied, a group that seems to be very vulnerable, who have ventured into a period without any income. This was a very common facet. And as you say, the numbers of homeless children, of children without a permanent place to live, have actually skyrocketed in tandem with our finding. That's one of the sort of confirmatory pieces of evidence that we suggest supports the trend that we see in $2 a day poverty.
And of course, it's hard when you don't feel like you have a choice to go somewhere else.
That's right, exactly. I mean, you're talking about a situation where families are powerless. They don't have anywhere else to turn, and they're dealing with crisis, and there's a constant movement, and I think this just puts them at a risk. I should say that when we looked into it, there's a very rich literature on adverse childhood experiences. It documents that the experience of physical abuse, of sexual abuse, of emotional neglect, is far more common in the population as a whole, not just poor families, but across the population as a whole. And it's something that I think affects people's life courses, as it does for especially the children in our book.
My guest is H. Luke Schaefer, a research affiliate at the National Poverty Center and associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Social Work. His new book is called $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. Today's conversation is part of KERA's ongoing One Crisis Away project, looking at life on the financial edge. At 6:20 during All Things Considered, KERA's Courtney Collins talks to Tony Milburn of Catholic Charities Fort Worth about the hidden cost of a poor credit score. We'll come back to this conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/mls.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is H. Luke Schaefer, associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Social Work and the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy, and co-author, along with Catherine J. Eden, of the new book, $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org, call us at 1-800-933-5372, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Luke, I want to talk a little bit more about Jennifer Hernandez, because she is like a poster child with no income for cobbling together every kind of free and low-cost opportunity for family support. She's going to, fairs where you get school supplies, and she's going to food banks. Researching and going to these events is like a job in itself.
That's absolutely right. It's a lot of work, and she was really she really does have a knack for that sort of thing. So one of her favorite things that she had done, one of the most recent times we had talked to her, was take her children to a production of Shakespeare in the Parks in Chicago. And as you said, they would go to any fair, dental checkup programs. Often these are limited to kids. As you would walk with her down one of the Chicago streets, her eyes would always be scanning the street for pamphlets that had been taped to the sidewalk or bulletin boards to see what was out there. And another thing that was quite common is for them to walk down to the local public library. So they would go often from the family shelter that they were in down to the nearest public library in Chicago, and that could be a safe space for them in a way, and a second home, or in this case, really the closest thing to home they had. They were so well known that when we went there, Caitlin, who's her daughter, I think was about 8 or 9 at the time, would just go over to the librarian, and the librarian would give her a set of books that she could reshelve for them. So that was her job, and she really loved doing her job. And Cole would pick out some books from the children's section. They would sit and do homework. They often couldn't actually get on the internet because they didn't have a permanent address, and we think Jennifer was too embarrassed to admit that they were living in the shelter down the street. But undoubtedly, it was a lot of work. This was a lot of work, and I think in some ways it was every hour spent waiting in line at a dental checkup for kids or school supplies or clothes giveaway is an hour taken away from her time looking for a job, which she was also very ardent in doing. But we shouldn't take for granted that this getting this kind of help can be a job in and of itself.
To be clear, as you are in the book, the 1996 welfare reforms did a lot of positive things for working poor families. But there wasn't any kind of cushion left for people at the very bottom. Was the assumption simply that anybody who was worthy of help would be employed and able to find some kind of job that is officially on the rolls?
Yeah, this is a complicated story that we try to tell in the book. It was a series of policy changes that the federal government made in the 1990s. That led to the situation that we're in now. So there were some very positive things, and these tended to be targeted at the working poor, people who had low-wage jobs and were able to maintain them. And one of the biggest parts of that was the expansion of the Earned Income Tax Credit, the EITC, which has perhaps the most arcane name in social policy parlance. Not like SNAP, which is very snappy. But the EITC is a wage supplement that the federal government distributes through the tax code that says if you're working, you don't just get back what you owe in taxes, but you might actually get more. You get back the total amount of the credit. And one of the unique and exciting things about the EITC is that instead of going down as you work more, up until you reach about earnings that lift you to maybe right around the poverty line, your EITC actually increases. So there's a very clear incentive to work. And we know that this program in and of itself has had a lot of positive effects and has really, I think, been a positive force in the lives of poor families. So we did that. We also expanded health insurance access for children, and that was a very positive thing. Our rates of being uninsured have really fallen, actually, over the last decade or two. But the stick was the 1996 welfare reform, which removed this entitlement to cash assistance, meaning if you had nowhere else to turn, there would be this cash assistance program. And I don't want to paint a rosy picture of that program. It was not well liked often by recipients, policymakers, and the American public. But instead of reforming it, our argument is in most places we basically got rid of it.
Have any nonprofit organizations experimented with giving particular amounts of cash to the people they work with rather than providing services or things like food and toiletries and clothing?
Yeah, I'm aware of some things that are ongoing with different nonprofits. I actually haven't seen a randomized trial or a major research study that evaluates a program like that. And so we're looking for that. And I think it's something that we'd like to see. One of the things that shows us that cash is so important to families, not all the families who we studied were on SNAP. And sometimes our programs are not good at dealing with this instability in housing and instability in life. But many did have SNAP. And so there was some resources coming into the house, and this is an important way that we think even here at the very bottom things are different in this country. But you would still see this incredible amount of work, this incredible amount of time doing whatever it took to get that little bit of cash, to get the little bit of cash that families needed to survive. And so it looks very clear to us that to survive in America and to get out of these types of circumstances, you really need to have access to a certain amount of income.
I think about kids in school, and like every week there's, you know, send $2 for this and $15 for that. It's hard to send kids to public school without a little cash.
Mm-hmm. And in a lot of cases, we would actually see a tremendous focus on dignity, right? So you have families who have nothing, and it's a very vulnerable place. But we would often see parents who would rather go hungry. And in some cases, we would have parents who, when they felt they had to, would actually sell some of their food stamps, their SNAP dollars, which is illegal. But they would trade them in for cash. You can do this at a steep penalty. You pay sort of a big fee in that for every dollar in SNAP that you sell, you might only get 60 cents back. But they would rather have the cash. And a lot of times, the first thing that cash would go to would be, reasonable school clothes for their kids to go to school. So their kids might not be signaled out to be, you know, the poorest of the poor in the school that they're in.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Bruce on the line in Pantego. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for having me on. For Mr. Shaver, I was wondering, instead of dealing with a lot of these programs, welfare programs, or like SNAP and a lot of these minimum wage laws, what if we go towards more of a universal basic income, something that's been embraced by both left and right-leaning mm-hmm. economists mm-hmm. as a better tool for, at least in America, to deal with poverty? Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Great point. I want to stress that the negative income tax that Bruce is talking about, or a guaranteed minimum income, is an idea that comes onto the public agenda from time to time. Actually, was once espoused particularly by Milton Friedman. And I actually have a paper that says we should consider a negative income tax. This would just be a program that would say if your income and your resources fall below a certain level, we're just going to lift you up to that level. And in a lot of ways, this is the most efficient thing we could do. There are some penalties in terms of work effort. We know that people reduce work a little bit, not a huge amount. when you have a negative income tax in place, but it's the most universal thing we could do. It actually might be the cheapest, I think, for one of the, you know, for one of the reasons that you pointed out, Chris, that if you're giving people income, actually, whenever you give them stuff or you create programs, you lose some of that money. And that's actually one of the good things about the earned income tax credit. It's not quite obviously a negative income tax, but all the money goes to the family, so you don't sort of lose it in the process. But I actually, as a result of the book, have sort of tempered my support for a negative income tax. When we would ask families, what do you want? If we came back in a year and you were doing well, you could have some support, what would it be? None of them ever pointed to more cash assistance from the government. That wasn't really on their minds, maybe because it was so uncommon. What they really pointed to was wanting opportunity to work. They wanted the opportunity to work in a decent job, to work in a job with quite a bit of across all of the families who we talked to, virtually all of them would say, I need a job that pays about $10, $12, $13 an hour, that has a stable schedule, because this unpredictability of work schedules was a major challenge in their lives. And they wanted to work both, I think, because that had the effect of sort of folding them into society. It also, they would point to a certain healing power of work, that when I had access to a job, when I was working, when I had the routine, I had a way to contribute, I felt better about myself. You know, my mental health challenges were most at bay. Our family functioning was best when the job wasn't sort of a job with a lot of problems like some of the ones we write about in the book. So where we come, first and foremost, we think the cash safety net is broken, and we'd like to do something about that. But what we really focus on, and it comes out of the stories of the families we follow, was a real look at increasing work opportunity for families at the very bottom. What can we do to increase the number of jobs that are available to people like Jennifer Hernandez, jobs that are stable and pay a reasonable wage? And we think that in a lot of cases, the families we follow might need a little bit of support to maintain those jobs. You know, they might need some wraparound services, some help finding childcare. But really, that is a type of program that we think helps incorporate families into society rather than isolating them. And I worry that a negative income tax, as much as it's more efficient and frankly it would probably cost less, will always be if it were to actually come to pass, would always be a stigmatized program, and is not, as far as we can tell, what at least the families that we talk to want.
So if we were going to work for something like a guaranteed opportunity for employment, recognizing that if people weren't working, they'd have to be let go, whatever, would that have to be a government initiative, or could the government offer tax incentives to private businesses to employ all these people? Is there enough work in America for everyone who wants it?
So I think that if you look around at the work that needs to be done, and in particular, look around at challenges with the 21st century infrastructure in America, I think there's plenty of work to be done. You know, what are the mechanisms by which we can make a serious extension of work, I think, are the challenges. That's the challenge for policymakers. But we have some good models that we should look at. There actually, not too long ago, was a temporary program sponsored by the federal government through something called the TANF Emergency Fund. It was a set of resources made available during the years of high unemployment. And they encouraged states to use some of that money to create programs that would actually partner with businesses. And to me, I think that's key, that we need programs that actually bring our business community in. And I think you see a lot of businesses that are starting to take the needs for employment across the board to heart. But we need to actively partner with them, and we need to say, we need you to create positions, good positions, new positions, not just filling a position you were already going to have, and partner with us on this. And we're going to give, you know, the parents who engage in these programs support. But it needs to be, I think, a challenge, and it needs to be a partnership. And this short-term program that we had that's no longer in operation, it was about a federal investment of $1.3 billion. It had the effect of generating 260,000 jobs during the period that it was going. And it was broadly popular among the states, among policymakers across the aisle, among the employers who were involved. And they said, you know, employers, we didn't get a randomized trial of it, but employers said, you know, a large majority of the positions that were created wouldn't have existed otherwise. And, of course, it was popular among the people who did get positions, and we see some good wage gains. So, and the last thing I would add on that is that I think these types of programs actually, just looking at the effect they have on earnings and wages is one thing. I think we also need to look at the effect they can have on some of these other outcomes that our families pointed to. What's the impact on mental health outcomes and physical health outcomes? There was actually a study of a program that guaranteed a job. It was a nonprofit program up in Milwaukee called New Hope. And it had nothing to do with marriage, yet when you looked at the families who were in the program, and this was a randomized trial, so we can feel really good about this evidence, years later, it had had this huge effect on marriage among never married mothers who participated. Just having the guaranteed job and the work support for this period of time increased marriage rates to a greater extent than any marriage promotion program ever seen. So I think we really have to look at the ripple effects of these types of programs.
My guest is H. Luke Schaefer, associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Social Work and research affiliate at the National Poverty Center. We're talking about his new book, $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. Tonight at 6:20 during All Things Considered, KERA's Courtney Collins talks to Tony Milburn of Catholic Charities Fort Worth about the hidden cost of a poor credit score. All of this, including today's show, are part of KERA's ongoing One Crisis Away project. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with National Poverty Center research affiliate H. Luke Schaefer, co-author with Catherine J. Eden of the new book, $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Luke, something that people may not be aware of is the fact that when these families get cash, sometimes they're able to find odd jobs, sometimes they're able to sell something. Sometimes what they're able to sell is their own blood, their plasma.
Yeah, we spend a fair amount of time in the book talking about writing about the survival strategies that people rely on to get that little bit of cash that can get them on to the next day. And something that we saw that was quite common was selling blood plasma. And we have an excerpt actually on this up on the at the Atlantic today that's from one of our chapters, particularly about Jessica Compton, who she and her husband Travis have two daughters, Rachel and Blythe, and Travis actually had been working at a fast food restaurant and had had his hours cut down to zero after the end of a holiday rush. And when we met Jessica, she was trying to give plasma as often as she could, which is you know, about two times a week over the course of a month. It took a long time, so she would go. She knew the process. She would get there and fill out the health forms. And she was small, you know, fair-skinned, and she has very smoky black hair. Because she's small, she would often have problems getting her iron up, so she had this ritual of taking iron-rich supplements right before she would go in to make sure she would pass that hurdle. And it was always a huge moment of anxiety whether or not she would be able to get back and actually give the donation, because if she gets turned away, of course, there's no cash. So it would, but when she would make it, she would go back and it would be sort of in a needle inserted, and it would extract the plasma, which is a rich, I think, component of blood that is used in the treatment of a fair number of diseases. One thing we saw from Jessica was she actually has a slight scar, an indentation in the crease of her elbow where she's been pricked so often for giving plasma that that it's left a mark. And we actually saw this fairly commonly across the families in different parts of the country. And if you look in your community, see if there's a plasma donation center. In some places, you might actually see it has its own bus stop, because it's a common strategy not just for the $2 a day poor, but the poor in general. So you can really sort of track if the bus stops right in front and everybody gets off and goes in, that this is in itself a survival strategy that people are relying on.
800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Allison in Richardson. Hi, Allison.
Hi, guys. Great show. I just wanted to find out, you made a comment earlier about giving cash rather than goods. And I know on Planet Money a couple years ago, there were a couple programs that they were reporting on in Africa that charities were actually just giving cash. And I didn't know if you knew whatever came of those programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I heard of them. These were some international programs, I think. And the challenge is, you know, the question really is, as a researcher, you know, what's our evidence that the cash matters? And we think there's enough evidence in our book, and we've certainly seen some examples both in the States and internationally of people going to this, but. In asking whether or not we have definitive proof that cash matters, that's I think the next question that we think, you know, we would like to do a randomized trial. In fact, I think any time we have a social program, whether or not it's counseling or food stamps or any sort of program that we have, any sort of service we want to provide families, I think we should always stack it up against what if we just gave people the income that from the cost of the program. You know, what if we just gave them the income instead of the service? What would the effect be?
Is there resistance to doing that kind of research? Because it seems like assistance to the poor is something that those who are maybe providing the assistance or providing for it feel like they know instinctively, maybe morally, what should be the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of resistance, and partially I think that's why we really focus on in the book and in the policy prescriptions, really focus on empowering programs that it create work opportunity rather than just this giving cash. We think that there should be a clear cash safety net for families at the very, very bottom, which we think is missing right now. But, you know, the programs that we really want to invest in, and I think we could get broad support for our programs that expand work opportunity, and they also happen to be what the families who we study want. Cash assistance itself has always been an incredibly stigmatized thing, and we can't get around that. And in some ways, you know, it's what led, I think, to the 1996 reform. It's what led to some of the expansions of support for working families in the 1990s. In the most advanced industrial and largest economy, having a little bit of cash at the bottom, we think, is clearly essential, especially to the families who we study.
Housing is a key component of your recommendations as well. How did you come to the conclusion that it is vital for very poor people with children to have private living spaces in which to raise their kids?
So the affordable housing crisis, I think, is quite extreme in the country and across, really across the nation, you know, at differing levels in different places. But so many families spend more than 30% of their incomes. So many families spend over 50% of their incomes on housing. It leaves a lot less for other things, and HUD refers to them as sort of cost burden. And especially for our families, as we saw, residential instability was probably the most common hardship, right? We saw in pretty much every case people having to double up with family and friends. And as you and I talked about, in a lot of cases that would not end well. And in fact, it was often something that would, I think, cause a spell of extreme poverty to spiral even further down and sort of extend it. So what we really think is people should have the right, especially if we expand work opportunity and people have the opportunity to work, which is not always true right now, but that people should have a place, should be able to have a place of their own. And as I think you pointed out, they could have the option to move in with family if they see that as a support, but that would be their choice. And so we need to do something to increase the ability of families to have their own place. And we have some good research that suggests when people have that ability, when they have access to a housing subsidy, they do better, crowding is reduced, and outcomes improve.
Back to the phones now. We have Ken on the line in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I'm really curious because we haven't really touched on it this hour yet. When you look at a presidential race, when you look at elections, and you know the voices of the poor, what do you see when you stare at the current polls, Donald Trump at 30% in many of these primaries, Bernie Sanders doing extremely well? What do you see? It's got to be different from what we're hearing on the various talking heads talk shows. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think that that Kathy and I would really like to see poverty on the public agenda. We'd like to see candidates talking about it in a sophisticated way. I actually think that over the last few years, there's been more discussion of inequality. And I think that's an important discussion. And it's related to what we're speaking about. But I think poverty is something that we really need to talk about in its own right. You know, however unequal a society is a different thing from where are people at the very bottom. And so I'd really like to see all of the candidates really address this in a serious way and think about what we should be doing as we move forward. And I think some of the policy recommendations we make could definitely get bipartisan support or might hold out the possibility of bipartisan support. So in general, I think in this cycle and in previous cycles, I'd like to see it discussed more, and I'd like people to bring interesting ideas and not just play into sort of stereotypes that don't necessarily have grounding in fact.
To what extent has the Social Security disability program become a de facto substitute for cash assistance?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question and something we've been thinking a lot about. There's actually two programs that sort of fall into this category. There's Social Security disability and there's SSI, Supplemental Security Income. And the second one actually is more commonly something that our families might interact with. It's a means-tested program, meaning there's a sort of an income threshold on it. And Social Security disability is a social insurance program that is available to all of us. And really the profile of people who receive SSDI isn't directly related to the families who we're talking about, who tend to be younger families and don't see it as an option and in a lot of cases don't have the length of labor force attachment to be eligible. Now, SSI over the last few decades has increased, and this is a program that's more relevant to what we're talking about. But it's still much, much smaller. Sort of the notion that it has replaced cash assistance is vastly overblown. You're still millions fewer when you count the TANF, who's on the TANF rolls, and SSI than those two programs 20 years ago. And in fact, our $2 a day estimates, when we say, you know, families who are surviving on cash incomes below $2 per person per day, 1.5 million households with 3.3 million children, that actually is after the effect of SSI and disability. So this is a program that I think plays an important role in the safety net, but you have to have fairly serious work-limiting disabilities to get on them. And frankly, a lot of our families want to avoid that. In a few cases, we thought some of the people who we write about in the book might be eligible for SSI, but I think it wasn't something that they actually wanted to apply for, because they wanted to be working. And once you get on SSI, it's a permanent program, and it sort of inhibits your ability to go to work.
You note that even when people are doing the best they can, work will sometimes fail.
That's right. So we saw just a lot of examples of instability in the jobs that were available to these families. So clear examples of labor code violations. So we saw people who worked overtime and reported to us that they weren't being paid their, you know, the overtime rate of time and a half. And we would always try to check this with, you know, people's accounts with things that we know about nationally. And we see that's very common. We would see people in very unsafe working conditions. So Jennifer Hernandez, who we talked about earlier, had been in shelters for months and finally found a job with Chicago City Custodial Services. And this was a house cleaning job, really. And when she started the job, she really liked it, and they were cleaning corporate apartments. But as the Chicago winter rolled in, things got colder and colder. She found herself cleaning mostly foreclosed homes. So these would be homes that had been shuttered for a long time, and there was no heat, so they'd have to wear their coats. There was no running water, so they'd have to bring their own water. And when the water got black with all the soot, because these places were very dirty a lot of the time, they would have to traipse up to a spigot at a neighbor's, you know, in a neighbor's house, or to the nearest gas station and fill up. So we're talking about very unsafe conditions. So if we're going to have a labor market like that, I think sometimes work just is going to fail.
The new book by H. Luke Schaefer and Catherine J. Eden is called $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. Luke, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Today's conversation was part of KERA's ongoing project, One Crisis Away, Looking at Life on the Financial Edge. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.